Hi, this is Dr. Sudhir Mohandas, co-founder and managing director of iFirst International. I'm here today with Sasi, the founder of EarthHair. Welcome, Sasi.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about your organization, plus more about you. And I'd like to just ask a little bit about your organization. Let's start off with that. Let's have a conversation on that.
Sure. So EarthHair is a social enterprise founded on February 14th, Valentine's Day of 2013.
Yeah, it's strange because I was born on that day.
Okay. Not in 2013.
No, of course not.
And we've been working with women, like marginalized women from different communities. And originally started working with artisans in Cambodia, Thailand, Indonesia, India. The main aim, I kind of probably need to talk about like why I founded it. So it was kind of accidental, but I would say that the journey towards starting EarthHair was a long one, in the sense that when I was young, I kind of knew that I wanted to do something with poverty alleviation. And I originally thought that was to do with if I could earn a lot of money, and then I would be able to use that money to, you know, build hospitals, schools, whatever it is, because I thought that's what poor people need. But then along the way, as I worked in banking and finance, I was very disillusioned with the idea of making money for money's sake. As in, I realized that the idea of working in an organization to make a lot of money was not enough of a motivator for me, and that I needed to feel greater purpose in what I'm doing. So I was in New York at the time, so I quit my job and went to Cambridge to do my master's. And because then I wanted to learn a little bit more about development studies, about policy, about conservation, about initiatives that could help reduce poverty. And why does poverty exist? I mean, because poverty doesn't exist because there isn't enough money in the world, or there isn't enough food in the world. It's because of policies and political systems that exist that keep people poor in some ways. So after doing my master's, I actually wanted to work in Africa, but I couldn't get any NGO to hire me at that point, because I was just a young 22-year-old with a master's degree and with the passion, but without any experience to help them. So I actually ended up coming back to Malaysia and working with my father. My dad used to run a railway construction company. So I worked with my dad for 2 years, and then got an opportunity to work with the UNDP in Ghana. So I left Malaysia and went to Ghana in West Africa and lived there for about 2+ years. And I was working with the UNDP there, and then ended up working with a non-profit there that was working with gold mining companies and helping communities that were displaced by gold mines. That was my first experience of understanding that a lot of nonprofits do a lot of great work, but struggle for funds, struggle for donations, struggle for grants. And that contrasted with my work in finance in New York, where we had a lot of money, but we didn't really, people don't really necessarily care about doing good. So that's when I thought, why can't why can't we keep doing good by earning money so that we can keep funding that without depending on the generosity of others to keep doing what we're doing. So I think that was sort of the planting of the seed of this idea of social entrepreneurship. And so that was in 2006, 2008, around there. And so after 2 years in Ghana, I ended up going back to London because I sort of kind of ran out of money. I had my student loans to pay, so I paid off my loans. And I went back to London, and I looked for a job in development consulting because that was what I was passionate about. But none of the development agencies or consulting firms had jobs or vacancies, so I ended up getting hired by a private equity advisory firm. So I kind of went back to my old life, but you know, they paid me well. So I worked with them for about 2 years. And then at this point, I was kind of reaching towards the end of my 20s, and I was about to turn 30. And that was when I started thinking about, you know, what am I doing with my life? And, you know, and I started thinking a lot about home and my parents, and Malaysia, and wanting to do something positive for Malaysia, because I felt that the impression of Malaysia outside of Malaysia was normally one of ridicule or not a very good impression. So I thought, you know, if there is a lot of corruption in my country, maybe, or things are not going well, maybe I should go back and try to do something about it. And also that, you know, I realized my parents were aging and I wanted to come back and spend time with them. So at that point when I came back, I think my dad was in his mid-60s. My mom was in her early 60s. And I think coming, like spending time, choosing to make that decision to be with my parents was probably one of the best decisions I've made, because I got to spend 10 years with my dad before he passed away last year. So anyway, I came back to Malaysia and I was thinking about what I should do back in Malaysia, because I mean, I knew that no job I would take in Malaysia would match my pay or that I had in New York or London. So, but then that's not the reason why you're coming back. You're coming back because you want to do good. And, you know, and if I earn a decent enough of a salary to support myself, that should be good. So I ended up working with Khazanah National, which is Malaysia's sovereign wealth fund. And why I took a job with them is because to me, Khazanah is sort of the custodian of a lot of the large companies in Malaysia, and it sort of is a custodian of the nation's wealth in a way. So I mean, it's one of the agencies that has that responsibility. So I felt like working with them would be contributing to the growth of the nation. And so that was a lot great experience for me, to learn more about Malaysian industry, Malaysian companies, Malaysian working culture. And I worked very hard. The working hours are very long. My dad was very proud of me, though. He would go around telling people, oh, my daughter works here. So I made a decision to quit about 2.5 years working at Khazanah. And the reason was because I felt, because I was in a way perhaps maybe overworked, that I fell asleep driving home from work. And so that kind of was like a wake-up call for me, because I thought, okay, you know, I like what I do, but I don't want to die for this.
Since you've been explaining this, I was just listening to what you were just saying, and it appears to be every stop you made to make a turn happens after 2 years.
Yeah. I mean,
Was that something that happened naturally, or just
happened naturally. I mean, I realized that as well. But I guess you could also think of it as like, you know, that's what millennials do. It's like every 2 years I was in a different country or doing something new. But I think this point when I decided to quit my job at Kazana was, I was in my early 30s. So at that point, it was sort of like, you know, I decided that whatever I did from that point on has to be something that I really believed in. Like, I don't want to just go and take a job because it pays me well. Like, I didn't want to do that anymore. So I actually took time off. I went to, so I'm a Christian, so I actually wanted to spend more time with God, I suppose, and I wanted to understand the basis of my faith, and because I mean I grew up in a Christian household, but you know, and I believed in God, but I didn't feel like I really understood a lot about God. And then I realized that in all other aspects of my life, with my education and my career, I always wanted to go for the best that I could, you know. So I pursued the best in what I could, but when it came to my relationship with God, it was kind of like relegated to the back burner. So I thought, why not just take some time and spend some time with God? And so I went to a school in Hawaii where I was learning natural farming and learning more about God, and that was about 3 months. And then after that, we actually went to build schools and teach English in Cambodia. And it was during that time when I really learned about the effects of, you know, how the Cambodian people had suffered under the Khmer Rouge. And a lot of their intellectuals and their skilled people with skills had been killed off. So a lot of the weavers and their knowledge and a lot of the mulberry trees had been destroyed. So the families that were still weaving silk, you know, made very little money, because mostly the people that bought from them made the money, not them. So then I started actually just buying silk scarves made by different communities in Cambodia that I met, and you know, just to help them. And I started buying them and started selling them to my friends and family in Malaysia, you know. And it wasn't like I intended to start a business or anything. It was just something that I was doing to help, you know. I thought, oh, here's like a small way that I can help these communities. So that kind of started growing a little bit, you know. And in early 2013, I met with a impact investor and venture capitalist. I mean, Dr. Kim Tan. He runs a biotech fund in London. He's Malaysian, and he said, you know, he listened to what I was doing, and then he said, you know, it's all well and good that you're doing this to help the women, but truly, if you want to continue to help them, you have to make this into a business so that there's sustainability. You know, and that kind of went back to the learnings that I had in Ghana, but I was not sure I was ready, in the sense that it's, you know, it's kind of a scary thing, I suppose, in a way, like, oh, you know, start a business, because I had been working for other people for most of my life. So now to like say, okay, you'll take the risk and put your name towards something and invest all your savings into something, and it may fail, you know, and then say that you're going to start a business, was a big decision. So but you know, my dad's an entrepreneur, and he always said, you know, if you work for someone else, there's a ceiling. But if you work for yourself, there's no ceiling. Which, of course, you know, is good and bad. Both have benefits and disadvantages. So anyway, I decided to take the leap and I went to register Earth Air as a real company. But for the first 3 years, 2013, 2014, 2015, it was just me. So I was literally just running the company from like my house.
So it was me, myself and I.
Yeah, it was like a one-man show who was doing everything. Sure. Like doing the sales, doing the marketing, doing the accounts, doing the sourcing and the quality control. And, you know, and traveling to meet the artisans to like design new products. So it was kind of like, you know, I was exhausted. I was mentally exhausted.
Could you say you burnt out as well?
Yeah, I mean, actually, August 2015, I thought of shutting Earth Air down. Because I thought I've given this almost 2.5 years, 3 years. So, you know, I still can't pay myself a salary. Then I'm wasting my time. But at that point, I got the Eisenhower Fellowship, which is a fellowship in the US. And so I had the opportunity to travel to the US and spend like 7 weeks meeting with other women leaders from around the world, and like meeting with different stakeholders in the US that I could learn from. So I met with different brands, working with artisans. I met with some retailers. I met with different companies. I met with a lot of museums, people who are building the craft community, craft movement in the US, because I wanted to understand, you know, how does a country like the US appreciate or have a strong maker movement, and a country like Malaysia that has a lot of craft that doesn't have that movement of appreciation, you know? So I wanted to like understand a little bit more about that. And so that experience was transformational for me, because the encouragement and support that I got from all the people that I met helped me sort of redefine what I'm doing.
You did that when you went into Eisenhower Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
Was that intended that you would get into that space, or you just
you have to decide who are the people you have to meet. So you have to plan your 7 weeks.
So you have to design your own.
Yeah, you have to design your own program. Right. Yeah. So
that was how it came at this point in time. I'd just like to ask you now, Sasi, is you mentioned your dad either directly or indirectly having a role in this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
Could you share a little bit some of those values that maybe he shared, or whether knowingly or unknowingly, but it sits in your philosophy or your work culture?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any of those things that have come through?
Yeah, I mean, my dad was probably like my greatest supporter and my greatest critic in starting out there. So he was originally very disappointed that I quit my job and I started out there, because he was like, why would you give up the salary that you have and to be earning peanuts? And, you know, he was like, I sent you for your education in Wharton and Cambridge, and he's like, you're selling scarves, you know. So to him it was like a waste of my talent and skills. So he said, you know, with your education and your intelligence, there's so much you could be doing. Why are you doing this, right? And I think I didn't want to disappoint him, but I knew that, you know, this is something that I believe in. But then as an entrepreneur in the first 3 years, I mean, you also have to be realistic and practical. So that was, you know, that was the dilemma that I was having, because I was thinking, I can't keep going on like this. You know, I like maxing out my credit cards. I put in most of my savings into the business, and, you know, and yeah, I mean, everybody's like, oh, what you're doing is so noble, it's so great. And I'm like, but platitudes are not enough to feed me, right? I need to be able to make money. and I need to be able to make this into something where we can actually pay people a salary to keep this running, right? So is there a real business case here that, and are we really adding value? So those were all of the things in my head, and you know, of course I was thinking a lot about, is this really the best use of my time? You know, could I be doing something else, working for someone else and creating a lot more impact? If that was my goal, if my goal is to create impact, then, you know, maybe I should go and work with like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or something, you know, like, and do big, big picture things. So those were all of the things in my head, and I sort of struggled with that. And the first 3 years, I mean, all of our stock was in our house, and I was living with my parents because that helped me save money. And like all of the products were in our living room, in the bedroom. And, you know, my dad would come home and be like, what is this? Is this a warehouse? You know, he'd be like, can you please like make our house a home? Like, I don't want to see all these things around, you know? And so I think it must have been frustrating for my parents. And also in the early years, I think in 2015, like we also had a lot of volunteers help. And so the volunteers used to stay with us in our house. So my parents not only had the stock, they had all these random people from like, you know, from around the world staying in our house. So my dad was like, what is this? You know, so, but these are the things that I had to do to build the business.
And these are the stories that have made that difference, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is what people don't see.
Yes.
Yeah, people see what we have now.
That's
and they don't
right.
understand, like, what I had to do and what I had to go through
exactly.
to come here. I mean, to get here. So I mean, I'm very grateful for the support of my parents. Because,
no
I
doubt.
Mean, they, as much as my dad grumbled, he didn't kick me out of the house.
Exactly.
He let me stay in the house and do what I wanted to do.
And that's what you mean by he was the greatest critic but the greatest supporter at the same time.
Yeah. And then slowly like Earth Air started getting a lot more media coverage. Actually, we started getting coverage the first year because the whole idea of social entrepreneurship was very new in Malaysia.
So I just but during that time there were many people I do know who were also trying to make that, trying to use artisans, you know, work, craftsmanship, and try to sell them and try to... What made yours a little different from the rest? Do you know?
I mean, I think maybe other people are trying to do it from a non-profit kind of view. As in like, oh, we're an NGO, we're helping this community, please buy, please help. But I didn't want to present the products that way. So for me, it was very clear from the beginning that this is a brand. You know, you have to create a brand because, like it or not, human beings psychologically pay for brands and will pay for value or perception, right? Rather than like an organization that's saying, oh, please buy this to help. So, I mean, I realized very early on that people will buy to help once or twice or, you know, but then if they don't think that the product is like good value or is aesthetically pleasing or is, you know, something that they take pride in, they're not going to keep buying it again.
So I think that's very powerful. Very powerful indeed what you just said. But we're coming close to the end now, and I'd just like to ask you, Sasi, what would be some of your parting words to our listeners?
I think maybe like I can reach back to what you asked me about earlier, like about my dad and what values he... So for me, the values that my dad taught me was... I mean, he really taught me about humility and hard work. Because he himself is an entrepreneur. Like, he shared with my family about how he started and how he struggled. And, I mean, until the day that my dad passed away, he was working longer hours than I was. You know, he was a 76-year-old man, and he worked way more than I did, and was working a lot harder than I was. And So I think that, you know, me and my generation, probably, you know, we've grown up, we didn't go through wars, we didn't go through the kind of lack that my parents' generation went through. So we're very different sense of what life is about, and I feel my generation and younger feel very entitled. So we definitely feel like life has to be a certain way and we deserve certain things. So I don't, you know, I feel like values of hard work and suffering may not always be there. And I'm not saying that you must go through suffering, but I just think that when you go through a lot of suffering and pain, and you realize what, how to appreciate life. And so I think my dad taught us that, even though we didn't go through that ourselves, because he shared with us his life and how he came up from nothing, and how he, as a poor young, you know, young boy growing up in a poor family, and how the lack that he had gave him the motivation to work hard and have really strong work ethics. So I think more than anything, my father taught me about discipline of work and of working hard and of not giving up.
And then, and I've kind of, just listening to what you just said, gives me the, tells me that you have a significant power in retrospecting as well as inwardly looking at things. And I think that's a very powerful thing as well. And will I have to close now? I'd like to ask you, Sasi, as to would you like to leave a website or a contact with our listeners?
Sure. So people can Google us. They just have to Google Earth Air. And our website is earthair.com, which is earthheir.com. And you can always drop us an email at hello@earthair.com.
Okay, so thank you very much, Sasi.
Yeah, thanks, Adi.
With that, we'll have to close. Those who are interested in visiting this podcast, please visit www.ifirstinternational.com.